You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
All right, Blake, here we are, episode number 44.
44 droopy drawers, Nick.
Yes, we just looked that up for all you bingo lovers out there. Apparently, two fours resemble a pair of trousers that have slipped halfway down someone's legs.
That is absolute rubbish. Anyway, what a great game bingo is. This week, who do we have on episode 44?
Well, episode 44, we have Ladislav Henry Gold, which just goes by the name Henry Gold.
Tell us a little bit about Henry.
Well, I just want to read out five things to you.
Give it to me.
Hugging the bear, kissing the cod, hippie trail.
Okay.
Truth, consequences, and UFOs.
Interesting.
Journey through time.
What do all of those things mean?
Those are just some of the routes you can ride on Henry's amazing cycling adventure company that he started at the ripe old age of?
50.
50. Incredible.
Just a boy, really.
Yes, he was.
So one day he said, I've got this crazy idea. And from that moment, that spark, he created this global cycling company. Should we hear Henry's story?
Yeah, we really should. It's a great humanitarian story that launched a global company. It shows you're never too old. Just give it a crack.
Here's Henry.
And don't forget, this is part A of our interview with Henry. Make sure you check out part B straight after. Hey, Blake, before we get stuck into this episode,
yeah,
where should our listeners go if they want to hear more stories of people doing?
They should jump on to www.thedoolanders.com.au. And what will they find there, Nick?
No, not .com.au, Blake, just .com.
Oh.
Don't make that mistake. You can hit us up on Facebook. You can hit us up on Instagram and our website. And you can find a whole heap of pictures, articles, links.
Recipes?
Not a ton of recipes, okay. But you just never know what you'll find. Thedoolanders.com. No.au.
Do it. Hi, Henry. Welcome to the Doolanders podcast. How are you?
I'm fine. It's a pleasure to be here.
Where are you beaming in from? Where do we find you today?
You're finding me in Canada, in Toronto, Canada. This is where I live now, my home.
Home of the Maple Leafs.
Home of the Maple Leafs, yes. They're not doing too well this year.
That's got nothing to do with a high performance coach.
I used to play quite a bit of hockey, but... I wasn't very good at it, so.
Right, okay. Hey, Henry, beaming in all the way from Toronto and Canada, can you tell us firstly, who are you? And then secondly, what do you do?
Well, my name is Henry, or actually my full name is Ladislav Henry Gold. And Henry was the middle name. I changed it when I came to Canada. I was born in Czechoslovakia, that's Ladislav, as compared to Vladislav, which is Russian. I emigrated here in 1967 went to school here, did a McGill engineering degree. And then eventually I ended up running this bicycle company, which I started with another fellow in 2002.
We'll dig into that a little bit now, right? So you're managing this, you created this NGO that actually provided humanitarian assistance to disadvantaged communities in Ethiopia and some other African countries. And you had this concept of producing and providing bikes for Africans so that they could commute like other countries did. Like you'd had a look into China and India and looked at the way that they got around. You thought, well, that makes sense for Africans to do that. Tell us about how you created the Tour d'Afrique and why you created that and the story of that creation.
So when I first worked in Ethiopia, when we started setting up projects there during the famine, I used to see women carrying heavy, particularly women, heavy loads on their backs. The whole life there was really limited to how far you could walk. And having sort of a background both in Slovakia, Czechoslovakia, where I grew up, which was, you know, after the war when I grew up, it's a fairly simple place. So a lot of bicycles and motorcycles. And then, of course, being an engineer and knowing how India and China developed, I kept saying, you know, this country, Ethiopia, poor woman, this country just needs some bicycles, cheap, solid bicycles. And I kept saying, somebody should actually set up a competition, because there were the bicycles. In Ethiopia, there were actually really nothing. But in Kenya and other African countries, there were. But if you try to buy one, by the time you know, a Chinese or an Indian bicycle would cost $30-$35 in India, it would end up being $200 in Africa. And, you know, the poor woman who carry these loads, there's no way they're going to be able to afford $200. So yeah. I thought, you know, if somebody could just set up and start manufacturing and get the market here competitive. And then, I kept saying somebody. Then one day, a fellow that I met before in another project in Sudan, finishing contract with Save the Children and came to me and he said, Henry, I want to work with you guys. You guys are different than everybody else. I want to work with you. And he was a Canadian, English back from, well, originally from England, had an MBA. And I said to him, listen, I have this crazy idea. I can't employ you right now, but I think I can raise some money. I like to do a feasibility study of producing bicycles in Nairobi. Are you interested? And he jumped on their idea, and we put a proposal together, and we managed to get enough money to send him to Nairobi. And that's he spent 6 months putting a feasibility study together and a business plan, and it all looked very good on paper anyway.
They always do on paper, don't they? Yeah.
So I said to him, let's do it. You know, are you interested? And initially he said yes, and then a week later or so, he told me he was not interested because he got a better offer. What was a better offer? You know, somebody was going to pay him $60,000 a year. Deloitte, I think it was a company, and he was going to be a consultant for them. So he dropped. But to go back to Tour d'Afrique, how it started, once we started, decided we were going to do this, he said to me, but Henry, we have no money. How are we going to do this? How are you going to pull this off? You know, I know you think you can pull off anything, but this is nuts. How are you going to pull it off? And I said, what's the problem? We'll just do a crazy bicycle race from Cairo to Cape Town, and it's going to be so crazy. And we're going to be doing it on the bikes that we actually are producing. That everybody will just laugh at us, and but it'll be a media event, and media loves kind of a crazy idea. So I said, why don't we just? That's how we're gonna do it. And I even said at that point, I think, and we're gonna call it Tour d'Afrique. Yeah, of course, apropos Tour de France. And that's how the concept came up. As I said, he then left me about a week later or so. I don't recall exactly the time now. And I was very busy with what I was doing. I was also at the time producing documentary films in Africa. I was very, very busy. So I said, okay, this is not going to fly right now. Put it aside and that's it. And we'll see. And then a few months later, one of my board members who was following my concept of factory in Africa, said to me, Henry, I know someone who just came back from Africa who's in a bicycle business. I think you guys should meet. And I said, fine. So we met and we had a few drinks. And he said to me, Henry, you don't want to go into bicycle business. The Indian and the Chinese are going to eat you. They're just going to run you dry. And he said, but I love the Tour d'Afrique concept. We should do it and make it a race. And we should do it. And so again, we sort of had this initial discussion, and then we followed up a few more times. And then he took the initiative. He put a little brochure, a kind of a prototype brochure together, And we met and I said, all right, let's do it. You know, we can do it. And then literally a week or two after, there was a terrible terrorist incident in Cairo, or in Egypt, actually, where about 60 or so German tourists were killed. You know, and this is the time where terrorist incidents were rare, at least of that site. So we realized that it's just not going to fly right now. So we put it aside and let it go. And then the years passed, and I did, you know, I left my job, then I did other stuff. He got in a terrible, serious accident. He spent 6 months in a hospital. But anyway, in 2002, when I had another project that didn't go, I called him up and I said, listen, we've been touching base every year that we're going to do this. But, you know, life interfered. Now I'm 50 now, so it's now or never. Are you interested? And basically he came back a day later or so and said, yeah, let's do it. And that was literally on my birthday and when I turned 50, that we decided to go for it. So that's the story of Tour d'Afrique very briefly.
Yeah. So you turn 50, your mate says, yep, we're going to do this. So for our listeners, tell us about that actual race. How many days did it go for? Where did you go from and to? What sort of, you know, countryside did you cycle through? Who were the people with you? Give us a little bit of shape and color around that story.
Well, Cairo to Cape Town is a bit of a, you know, legendary thing, or Cape Town to Cairo. If you are South African, if you are English, it's probably Cairo to Cape Town. And it sort of had this route, you know, that you look at the map and you sort of think, well, more or less going north south or south south north. So we laid out the route, basically going through Egypt, Sudan, then Ethiopia, then Kenya, then Tanzania, Malawi. The first one we actually went to Mozambique, then Zimbabwe, then Botswana, and finish in Cape Town. And the idea was to try to do it in 100 days of cycling. And then every few days we would take a rest day. So the concept was it's going to take us 120 days. That was the assumption that we could do it in 120 days. And it worked. We had no idea first how this is going to happen. We sort of figured out the logistics, how we're going to do it. We're going to rent a couple of those big overland trucks and adjust them and adapt them to our needs. So we're going to have a support crew. We had to worry about food and water. And of course, one of the biggest challenges was, and that's why everybody thought this was crazy, was first of all, you're going through the Sahara Desert. So, you know, taking a group of 35, 40 people through the desert, you got to think of water, you got to think of food. But also, you're going through, at that point anyway, you're going through countries that, for example, starting in Egypt, outside of Cairo, the only way you could travel if you were a foreigner was in a convoy, you know, buses, not even private cars, buses. Going all the way to the border, that was the only way to go. Similar situation in northern Kenya. You can only go in a convoy. There were some issues also in northern Sudan and in Ethiopia as well. Again, we needed to organize permits for all these places. So that was the biggest challenge. But to be honest with you, for me, it wasn't a challenge at all because I happen to work in these countries I made some very good friends there who had very good contacts. So when I decided to do this, I literally from my home emailed these people and I said, listen, I'm going to do this. Can you help me getting these permits? And I literally got emails back. It said, Henry, consider it done. And I thought they were flipping. I thought, like, come on, you know, they're taking me for a ride. But I knew these people, so it didn't sound like them. But they came through, each and every one of them. They just tell me what to do, how to do it, and it was done. They had the connection right at the top. Perhaps because the people at the top maybe didn't understand what the heck we are planning to do. But yeah. that was the biggest challenge of course, the other challenge was people are terribly, terribly worried about security I had participants on that trip who towards the end of the trip admitted that they thought they're coming to die. You know, they thought they were like the old explorers who came, you know, who just felt they had to do this, but they thought they're coming to die. So there were some psychological issues that we had to face. But thanks to me working in Africa and feeling comfortable in Africa, it's the only reason this ever happened, because it was the work I did, you know, the altruistic work, if you want to call it that, I did before that.
It doesn't sound like a lot of stuff you'd put in the brochure, where come and die. Yeah. In this cycle race. But just talk me through. So I think all our listeners will also be scratching their head here. So our vision of the Sahara, right, is just...
Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah. Well, maybe, yes, that sort of thing. But just sand dunes. How do you actually ride through the biggest desert on the planet?
So that's one of the misconceptions. There's no huge sand dunes. There is sand, of course, but the route we actually chose, just about 95% of the time, maybe 90% of the time, was literally beside the Nile. So you don't just cut through Sahara, you go around the Nile. And around the Nile, there are villages. And as a result, there are roads to get to these villages. So it's often sandy, very sandy. There were days that, you know, you walked a few kilometers. There were days where we were cutting through a very sandy desert, if you will. But there were some hard patches. So you could cycle for 2 or 3 kilometers. You could actually see someone beside you 100 meters to your left cycling and passing you because he had a hard patch. And then half an hour you were passing him because you were on a hard patch. So there were this kind of a possibilities. But yeah, on a mountain bike with white tires, we made it. That's the fact. But so this is what happened.
Got it. Who was in charge of talking to the people along the way, who, one, thought they couldn't make it, two, thought they were going to die, three,
had so much sand in their pants.
Yeah, like their bum was sore. It was just ridiculously hard. Was that your job to motivate them and inspire them to keep on going?
Well, I'll tell you a little anecdote. I thought I wasn't going to cycle much. I wanted to cycle, but I had no idea how much. Because, first of all, I'm not a shape. I wasn't a serious cyclist at all. I've never done anything like this. So I didn't know. Deep down, I thought I could do it. But I had no idea what I was getting myself into. But anyway, as a result of this, we hired a so-called tour guide, a tour leader. Who spend his time on vacation and working for these typical European holidays or Canadian holidays, you know, that's what he did. So we hired him to essentially be the tour leader and talk to people and encourage them, etc. Well, first day out of Cairo, I get to lunch and I'm very, very slow. So I'm the last person coming in. To my shock and surprise, at lunchtime, and we set up this lunch halfway every day. It would be a truck waiting, or more or less half the way, and waiting. And that's where we set up the food and particularly water. That was always, and rehydration drinks, etc. Some bars. But I get there, and there's about a dozen people, including the tour leader, kind of loitering around. I said, what the heck is going on? I said to myself. I was exhausted just getting to lunch. I was completely gone.
Day one. lunchtime.
I mainly because I was up till 3 o'clock in the morning, and I haven't cycled. I haven't done anything for 6 weeks because I brought the trucks from Nairobi up to Cairo. And I can tell you about the logistics nightmare that we had just because, like 3 days before the tour started, we had no idea whether the trucks are going to be allowed from the customs. And the Egyptian told us over our dead body. And it was a nightmare. But we managed. So I haven't been sleeping. I had a terrible cold. And I'm getting to lunchtime where I think I'm gonna pack it in, you know, enough for me. I'm not racing. This is not any challenge for me. I just want to be on a bicycle as much as possible. I get there and I get my sandwich. I'm looking at all these people sitting around, kind of very unsure of themselves. You know, they're wondering, what the heck did we get ourselves into? By the way, out of Cairo wasn't bad because it was paved road. So it wasn't that difficult. No difficulty. But, you know, it's Africa and it's surrounding. They've never been to Africa, any of them. And I'm finishing my sandwich, and then all of a sudden there's a commotion around the truck. So I jump out to see what's going on, and I see tour leader on the ground, out.
What? Collapsed? Unconscious?
Unconscious. So
tour leader.
We had a nurse with us, I grabbed some water and slapped him around a little bit, and the nurse came and started taking care of him. So we revived him and put him in a truck. That's the purpose of the truck, you know, you have people, you carry people. And then I look around, you know, I see dozen cyclists that if you tell them right now there's a vehicle going back to the airport, all 12 of them are going to jump on the vehicle. So I said to myself, yeah. Well, you know, this is not the way to start a tour. The tour leader is like fainted. So I said, well, Henry, and I'm talking to myself, you got to do something here. I said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I guess I better tell everybody lunch is over. We got to move because otherwise we're not going to make it. Everybody get on their bike and let's go. No time to waste. And I'm saying to myself, you're going to die. You're so exhausted, you're going to die. Anyway, I promised myself I'm going to do 5 kilometers and hopefully everybody's on their way you know, I can get in the truck. Of course, that didn't happen. Every 5 kilometers, I said to myself, another five, another five, another five. Eventually, I made it all the way. And then I realized that I really had no choice but had to be the tour leader. You know, lead by example. Not that I was leading. I was joking around. I was leading from the back. because that's where
All great leaders do that. All great leaders do that, Henry. Just leading from the back, pushing them forward. What a cracking story. So in little 5 kilometer increments, you cycled for over 120 days. Like, that must have been, to have the willpower to do that, you must be such a determined person.
I never thought of myself that way. Maybe stubborn is the right word. Determination, I don't know if I'm that determined. But I guess I don't like quitting. That's the main thing. You know, it's just personality, I suppose. It's something that that's there. And, you know, and I have tested myself before, so I knew I what I could do. I was in hardship situation. I grew up with two parents who went through hell in World War II. You know, and I was very much aware because they talked about it. You know, as a kid, I always sort of wondered, as an adult, I wondered, you know, how am I going to perform under pressure? What am I going to do? How am I going to do this? And so sometimes I put myself in this sort of situation, and then I had to do what I had to do, essentially. So I don't know when I'm determined, but it's just sort of being on the spot. And you say right now, you can't collapse. You got to do what you have to do. That's all.
Wow. So you make it, right? And you've created this, amazing event. So out of that was born TDA Global Cycling. And today you run this organization that basically takes people on adventures on bikes right across the globe. So there's touring, adventuring, expeditions, bike packing, And here's some of the amazing things that you can do. So you can go on tours. You know, one's called Hugging the Bear, Nick, from Vancouver to Calgary. There's Kissing the Cod, which is from Halifax to St. John's. You can cycle from, Henry was telling us just before we came on air, from Darwin down to Melbourne and then over into New Zealand. There's a North American epic Silk Route, the Hippie Trail, like Hanoi to Singapore, all of these amazing things. Henry, how many cycling expeditions have you been on post your 50th birthday?
Well, I don't really count, to be honest with you. I've done all the big ones, not all the big ones, because we have kept... so let me put it to you this way. From 2003 until 2011, I cycle every time we had a tour. I always wanted to be on the first tour we ever designed, simply because you know, this is where the unexpected thing happened, and I like to be there when things happen. I want to take the responsibility. But then in 2011, it's 10 years ago now. We were on a trip in India, and I had a very unfortunate incident. I was literally run over by an elephant. So then I stopped.
So many people who can say that.
So tell us about what happened. What, you're in India, you're on your bike. What happened?
So we had this trip that started in Delhi and was supposed to go all the way to Kanyakumari. It went all the way to Kanyakumari. I didn't. Only a few days before then, about 8 or 9 days, if you know India, we were in a city called Mysore, and then we cycled to a kind of a really nice place, almost a wild India, where we stayed in a lodge, lovely lodge. And then we continued, and the pace we do it, the way we do it is that everybody sort of goes at their own pace. They get the information where to go, how to go. Our vehicles go ahead, at least one of them usually. And then people finish their breakfast and they pack up and they go. Sometimes they do as a small group, sometimes one by one, sometimes a larger group. Anyway, as I'm always the last one, I came out of the lodge, and there's a young woman who was with me actually in a previous trip in Africa, who was having problems with her bikes. So I helped her to be the bike, and then we got going, and maybe 5, 6, 7 kilometers out of the lodge, we were going up the hill. She was ahead of me about 25 yards or so. And we were on a very narrow road, paved road, but narrow, between essentially in a forest, very lovely forest. And we were going uphill. And then about uphill, sort of, I don't know, 100, 150 yards ahead of us, we saw an elephant, a wild elephant, crossing with two young ones behind her. And I was actually very excited for her because she was with me in Africa, and we go through Botswana where we all see, all of us, we actually have a section, we call it Elephant Highway, where we all see elephants. And when she was in Africa with me that year, she didn't see an elephant. So I was very excited for her. I said, well, there you go. What a present she's getting. And both of us, you know, didn't stop because it didn't feel particularly threatening in any way. And so as I kept cycling, I kept saying to myself, well, I wanted to see if I can still catch a glimpse of the elephant. So I kept looking to my left, and I got to about the spot where I thought this is where they disappeared into the forest. So I said, well, I guess I missed them. They're in the forest. They're gone. And literally as I had that thought, a charging elephant came at me, but when I saw it, he or she broke through the trees and was running full speed. And I would say, I don't know, 10 yards when I spotted him. Anyway, at that point, I sort of thought, well, I certainly am not going to get away from him going uphill. So let's see if I can make a U-turn here and get away from him or her. Again, I have no idea which, whether it was male looking over the female, protecting the female, whether it was the mother. As I made that, as I tried to make that U-turn, I fell. Because the road was narrow and the shoulder was very high. These Indian roads, I don't know if you've ever been there, they're almost like six inches above the shoulder. So I had to try to stay on the road. I fell. At that point, you know, mind takes over whatever it does. In my case, it calculated that the only chance I have was to get into the forest. And also it made the decision in my mind that I'm going to run almost towards the elephant, but in an angle, sort of, let's call it 45 degrees or so, so that the elephant, to slow him down, to force him to make a U-turn. So of course I, you know, I was a world record runner at that point. I heard behind me as the elephant is stepping on my bike. So I congratulated myself. I said, wow, this works. So then I made another U-turn, sort of a sharp turn, because I figured now I have to get between, try kind of between the trees, move around. And as I made the turn, I felt essentially something grabbing me by the ankle. It was the trunk of the elephant catching me, and I was in there. So the next thought was very simple. You know, we Canadians are often told that if a grizzly bear attacks you, just go into fetal position. So I thought, well, maybe that's the way to do this. So I was trying to get into fetal position where, and then the next thing my mind processed was that the helmet cracking, the plastic of the helmet cracking. And interestingly enough, you know, you would expect, as people say, you would expect that your life would cross in front of your eyes. In my case, I had this crazy thought saying, well, this is very interesting. What's going to happen next? What is next?
So hang on. So the elephants swooped down.
It's grabbed gone, it's grabbed, gone, thank you for slowing down and going in the fetal position.
Yeah, it's grabbed you by the leg. It's grabbed you by the leg with its trunk. You're down on the ground. You're in the fetal position. It's stood on your head. Your helmet's gone cracked, and you're thinking, I wonder what's going to happen next.
Well, again, these things happen quickly, right? It's the only thing I recall, the helmet cracking, and I'm on my side trying to pull myself into fetal position. And then the next thing I recall is whether I lost consciousness for half a minute or a minute, or whether the brain simply deletes the things that are painful. I don't know, because the next thing I recall, I'm basically flat on my back, and I see the elephant kind of disappearing in the forest, running away from me just as quickly as he attacked me. So I was on the ground, and I sort of lay there, and I was sort of pretty convinced that I had a broken back. So I lay there still. Just a few months before that, I took some wilderness first aid training, so I knew the basic how to start checking yourself, what works and what doesn't. So as I lay there, I started doing that. I started moving my toes, and that was fine. It works. I congratulated myself. I moved the other toes and that worked. Then I lifted the knee. I said, well, that's not bad. It's working. I lifted the other knee. And then I sort of thought, well, the next thing would be, if you're going to move, you got to move your head. But then, of course, you know, in the first aid training, if you have any kind of injury, they tell you not to move your head because you may become quadriplegic. So I lay there for, 10, 15, 20 seconds. And then I sort of convinced myself, I'm in a forest. Nobody's going to find me here. So I better just try to see if I move my head or not, whatever the risk is. And I did. And that wasn't the smartest thing to do. But fortunately, my back wasn't broken. My neck wasn't broken. There were a bunch of other broken bones, which I can give you a list if you want. I did have a cracked back. I did have cracked ribs. So whatever the elephant did to me, turned over, he stepped on me at least once very seriously, well, more than once, because he broke my shoulder, he broke my upper arm, my wrist, my orbital bone, this one right here, was cracked. That's wow. Probably from the helmet, the bone when he stopped on me, on my head. But without any question, the helmets saved my life.
Saved your life. Yeah.
That was the end of part A of this interview. Part B begins right now.